listeners, and welcome to the Unions 21 podcast, your digital download of all that's good, innovative, and downright interesting in the trade union world at this precise moment in time. With me, Simon Sapper.
And me, Becky Wright.
And you're very welcome to this episode. In a little while, we'll be hearing from Christina Colcroft and Johnny Penn, who, I've got to tell you, have got two of the biggest brains, but the nicest personalities you will ever encounter in the trade union world or any other. They're going to be talking about how the robots can be tamed, how the advance of AI isn't necessarily bad news for all of us. But before that,
yes,
your eye, Becky.
I'm going to give a special shout out to former Unions 21 fellow Stephen Littlewood of the FDA. The FDA have just launched their Manifesto for Justice, which is really interesting. Basically, it's supported by the Bar Council and the Law Society, endorsed by the Secret Barrister. And it kind of is a manifesto for the justice sector. FDA represents members in the CPS. Basically, it outlines four things: a properly resourced CPS to protect the public with robust an effective prosecution service, no more cuts to legal aid, investment in digital disclosure, competitive pay and fees to recruit and retain lawyers for a sustainable criminal justice system. And I, other than it coming from Stephen, I tell you why else it caught my eye is because, you know, I've been thinking about what is collective voice and collective bargaining, what do we constitute it as? And even though this is technically a campaign, I think there is call to say this is some form of collective bargaining, you know, and it's kind of getting out to the wider industry. It's making it an issue that everybody in this industry should care about, not just about vested interest. The competitive pay and fees is all part of it being properly resourced to have an effective criminal justice system. It's not just because members want higher pay. And well, I totally support CPS members if they want iPay.
It's the golden binary, isn't it? It's something that, yes, directly appeals and is relevant to FDA members, but is also of relevance to the whole sector. And in fact, given the role justice and a properly resourced justice system plays in society as a whole, it's a fundamental message about society and the way it's being systematically taken apart and repressed by those who are running the country at the moment.
I think it's a great piece of work, and I really wish them well on that and hope that they get some traction on it.
And they've got a petition, haven't they? I think if you go over to their website, which is www.fda.org.uk, you'll find the link fairly, either on or fairly near the front page, and I know they're looking for as many signatures as possible.
Go.
Well, I've got to say, from my point of view, Becky, at this time of year, my heartstrings always feel a little tug in the direction, usually of Bournemouth this year, to the CW conference, where I spent many happy years.
Bournemouth?
CW has it has pride in its democracy. It's got a big conference. There's a limited range of places it can go to, and Bournemouth kind of fits the bill still. And the conference had good news today because a recognition deal has been struck between EE and the CWU. I saw on social media and elsewhere my old colleague John East, the national officer responsible for that part of the union's work, telling conference about what it's all about. And that's really a really good piece of work. Recognition deals are hard to come by in that sector.
Congratulations to the CWU.
Great. So now to the main event. I tell you what, pin your ears back and settle down comfortably with a cup of tea or whatever your beverage of choice. This is good. This is good. Here's Christina and Johnny in conversation with me a couple of weeks ago.
I'll start off by welcoming you and asking you perhaps to describe who you are and what you do.
Hi, I'm Christina Colcroft. I'm director at UniGlobal Union for all things digital, so to speak. So I do a lot of work across the world on data governance, AI, how is the world of work changing, and what should the union response be? Basic terms, that's what I do.
You try and predict and control the future.
I would like to look into the glass ball, but we don't actually have to do that. We just have to look around what's happening around us.
Well, let's come to that in a moment, but Johnny.
My name is Johnny Penn. I'm based at the University of Cambridge. I study long-term implications of artificial intelligence and work with a group at Harvard University called the Berkman Klein Center, who are interested in kind of contemporary policy and things like this. And so Christina and I have become great friends working on a project together to try and help young workers improve their quality of life and quality of work in the world today.
Listeners, I have to tell you, I'm getting distinctly uncomfortable here because the size of the brains of the two people in front of me kind of pushing me to the side of the room. Well, I mean, but seriously, this is really fascinating stuff because when we talk about digitalization in general terms, but when we distill out that artificial intelligence, we are at best, probably the labour movement's got an uncomfortable relationship with that because the headline is AI is going to get rid of loads of jobs. There'll be new jobs, but they probably won't be as good, in whatever that means, as old jobs. And actually, AI is used to constrain and control your life rather than to empower. But I would imagine, you would take a much more upbeat view of the potential that.
Yes and no. I mean, I think there's been a lot of fear mongering going on. At the moment, actually, bar very few sectors, we see that the number of jobs is actually increasing, even though AI is being introduced. But you're very right, Simon, that we have to ask, what are the quality of these new jobs? And unfortunately, there, we see a race to the bottom, right? Rise of precarious work, rise of non-standard work, which is becoming more and more the standard, right? But that is that AI's fault, or is that the fault of politicians who don't want to regulate and protect good jobs? So that's a separate discussion. But yes, I think the thing that got Johnny and I together, we met at an event in Brussels, was the big question, how can we use the potentials of this technology, but for good? You know, how can we use it to strengthen in our current project young workers' position, but all in all, you know, everything to do with people and planet, workers and so forth?
Can it be used for good?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it can, and we have to be smart about it. You know, we have to look at what is the current situation, what are the current norms driving artificial intelligence, driving the data behind it, driving algorithms. And then realize, and this is a pertinent issue for us, I think, that we mustn't talk about AI as if it's something uncontrollable. This is the biggest fallacy. It's like when people talk about the markets. The market is temperamental today. You know, they're putting sort of a personhood onto the market. And the same is happening with AI. Oh, the robots are coming, or AI is destroying jobs. Well, it doesn't have to be like that. You know, where is the human agency? Where is the resistance, the desire for change, and of course, the political response?
So you mentioned a project involving young workers, Young Workers Lab, I think it's called. I mean, does that embody some of this optimism and this proactivity in terms of harnessing AI for good purposes that we've been talking about?
Sure, yeah. I mean, in our view, you know, technology is a means, not an end. You use it, you have to think of what your values are and then how you can use technology to bring about those values and bring them into the world. And the Young Workers Lab, the idea there is to have a lab, to have a space to experiment with things like, you know, digital apps, eventually artificial intelligence, to think about how we could use them to benefit workers. One of the examples that we've talked about is starting to, if you're in the movement, structure your data the same way. Now, this is going to sound a little bit boring, but you'll start to see the potential in the long run of how powerful this can be. Structuring your data in such a way that unions in different contexts could start to understand the sort of issues that they deal with constantly. So, you know, if you had to make a map in your local area of the sort of calls that you get, the requests that you get in meetings from members, the sort of things, if you had to make a chart of all of them, and you could compare that chart to someone in another context. So let's say you're in Canada, and you could compare that with someone in Indonesia or in the UK or in the US or anywhere, and start to, like Darwin charting the animals, or look at the kind of full taxonomy of all different indicators that work that they give us. Then in the long term, you could start to see how things like artificial intelligence are changing the way we work. Now, a lot of unions already have this data, but it might be in a filing cabinet or on a drive.
Well, certainly not in the same language or the same format.
Exactly. And so one of the many things we've been looking at, just as an example, is what we've called MetaUnion, and it would be an open data standard, which says, okay, if you're gonna pay money to structure your data, which just means to kind of clean it up and organize it, maybe put it in an Excel spreadsheet so it's easy to analyze. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. If you do that the same way, if all of us kind of aspire to do that in a similar, according to a similar standard, then suddenly we're all speaking the same language. It's like the metric system. We all have this similar approach to measurement that with tools like artificial intelligence becomes very powerful, right? Because suddenly you can start to see into people's work life with clarity the way that big businesses like Amazon or Google look into our personal lives or our shopping lives. And unions haven't taken this step yet, really, to start protecting workers with that sort of that level of analysis.
Why Young Workers Lab as opposed to just Workers Lab?
Good question.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, we could have chosen any lab because
Middle-aged Workers Lab doesn't have the same ring to it.
Instead of All Workers Lab. No, I mean, of course, whatever we're producing and developing here will be useful for all groups of workers. It could be, you know, groups of workers around gender, ethnicity, location, skills, age, whatever. But, you know, to make sure that we were not going on a mission creep trying to save the planet, we focused in on a group of workers who are distinctively different from you and I. Well, now, people can't see us, but we're not the youngest people on the planet here. And this is also why I brought Johnny in, because he is a young worker and has and challenges as well many of the concepts I have of a good life.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, I noticed in the work I do with many unions, the defining demographic is age. It's not race. It's not gender. It's not sexual orientation. It's age. And I think, you know, people often talk in Britain about the millennial generation and having different values or different ways of thinking. Sometimes, as putting it as crudely as that, and therefore you say you're not out to save the planet or to save the movement. Actually, I think de facto you are, because inevitably young workers of today will become older ones of tomorrow,
exactly,
and more experienced officials and more senior, yeah, officials, hopefully.
And I think, you know, I remember in when I was a researcher years before I joined the union movement, I did an analysis then of the contact points a union typically had with their members. And, it was 80%, 85% the same people who came to every single meeting. So the actual contact points, the actual face-to-face interaction the union had with the members was limited to relatively few of their members. And this is why also that Johnny and I discussed, well, in this fragmented world of work where people are domestic workers or working from home or freelancers, how can the union be present, be active in these workers' lives? And this is why we are testing one of the tools we call a virtual town hall. So it's like bringing the member meeting but into the virtual space. Mm-hmm. So everybody who maybe doesn't have time to cross town and go to a membership meeting, or we've heard from many young people, they go and then they say, but everybody in the room was 55 plus or 45 plus or 40 plus. And, you know, I didn't feel there was space for my, yeah, opinions. Or also, and let's face it, the silent voice. You know, the people who don't like speaking up in public. So we're testing this tool, and already now it's bringing some great results, right?
Can I, forgive me, no offence intended by the question I'm about to pose, but that's almost like it could be not much different to a combination of WhatsApp and Slack, I don't know. But, I mean, or is that the beauty of it, that actually the basic technology here exists already, it's just the application?
To go back one step and then to answer this question, you know, part of the reason that we have set up this Young Workers Lab is we feel like young people are facing a lot of the issues that could affect all work, or are already starting to affect all different types of work. So young people are three times as likely to be unemployed these days as older people. 65% of young women in OECD countries said that getting a well-paid career would be the hardest challenge in their life. More than buying a house, more than having kids or starting a family. It would be, you know, getting a decent job and holding it. And so young people are unsettled. And I think I equate this to the kind of mental health conversation now that we talk about people's unhappiness and disillusionment, I think part because of big structural changes that have, yeah, yet to come. To bring this now back to like specific technologies, the thing is, you know, one of the main pieces that drives Christina and I is just having imagination around what could be. This virtual town hall tool is just an off-the-shelf survey service that we got. It's not something we built custom, but the reason we like it, the fact that it's off the shelf, is if after this conversation you're working in a union and you want to use it, you can go and use it. Yes. It's called Thought Exchange. And the reason it's not quite Slack and not quite WhatsApp is that it's anonymous. And so the characterization of a virtual town hall explains some of it, but the full picture is kind of even cooler than that, because if you're not the type of person that speaks up in a meeting because you're worried that there will be retribution, or because of the gender dynamics in the room, you don't think you'll be heard, or age dynamics in the room. Yeah. This service, because it's anonymous, lets you weigh in. And it also, there's artificial intelligence and natural language processing happening in the background, where if you wanted to canvas, 1,000 people, you can then see in the background, in the analytics on the back end, after everyone's submitted and voted on what their favorite answers were, the kind of feelings of the group. So maybe this percentage of the group feels this way, and that percentage of the group feels the other way. And you can then use that to make informed decisions about how to help everybody.
And I think what Johnny's saying there is like really important, because what this tool and the other one that we're actually developing will help the unions do is test our assumptions. We might assume in a collective bargaining round that this group of workers, they want higher pay. But if we had done the virtual town hall with them, the thought exchange, and asked them, for example, what would be the top issues for us to raise in the collective bargaining round, somebody might have said a three-day weekend. Or somebody else has said more focus on mental health. Somebody might have said the right to disconnect. Or I want commuting time to be part of my work, regarded as part of my work. So suddenly we'll be getting in, and they can, as Johnny said, they can upvote each other's responses, and we'll be sitting there saying, wow, they prioritize these three things as the top three things, but we thought they wanted something different.
That's right. They weren't even on our negotiating agenda, but actually, if they are, A, we satisfy members and reflect members' views, and we become more effective in an organizing sense as well as a negotiating sense.
Yeah. And it's also, this is a lab, so it's the other thing you could do with a tool like this is canvas, members about what's dangerous about your job that we don't know about. And then see the question like that. You can plug any question into this tool. And then you have, empirical evidence of, this percentage of this working group feel unsafe in this way.
Of course, that's particularly important when we have a fissured economy, as some people call it.
Exactly.
Platform-based working. I think in this country, 3 or 4 years ago now, I suppose, they're using the technology that was available at the time. People who worked in McDonald's started talking to each other.
Yeah.
And they all found exactly the same health and safety issues, which you kind of expect in terms of burns, and what an issue this was. But of course, it doesn't have to be that sort of health and safety stuff. It can be a particular facet of work that is undetected. Like again, in the States, I think through Coworker, they discovered that in Starbucks, I think it was, there was a very large preponderance of people who basically had to lock up at the end of a shift, and then a relatively short period of time later had to open up for the start of the next day's business. And this was a problem. People were getting knackered, they weren't having enough sleep, all the rest of it. That's my listeners will forgive me if my recollection's a bit faulty, but that the principle is sound. Right. That actually things that are undetected suddenly don't just become visible, but quantifiable.
Yeah.
But this is precisely one of the driving things behind the Young Workers Lab, is how do we, in a responsible way, so not just by surveying our members and subjecting them to even more data surveillance, but how can we responsibly find out what is their world of work? Are people getting rest breaks? How much are they on their feet? For Amazon workers or fulfillment center workers of any kind, how far do they have to walk per day? Are people sleeping well? So we can take this information, which will be statistical, which will be undeniable, which will be provable, and go to management or go to government and say, look, you've got to see this, and start negotiating with management around changing working times or changing working conditions or so on, because it will give us the necessary proof of our members' working lives, right? Right. Unfortunately, we're in a world right now where anecdotal stories, they might touch, but they don't necessarily change.
Yeah. And simultaneously, automation, historically, it doesn't always take jobs away. It sometimes redistributes tasks and can hide certain things that as you use the word, like the hidden labor that we see. In this lab, what we're experimenting with is, what sort of glue could we put to kind of peg to bring these people back together? So if you're working for a platform organization that you never meet your coworkers and you never meet your boss because you work through an app, how would you ever be able to express your needs?
Exactly. So, and presumably though this works in two different ways, and they each way has, there's a challenge in this in the sense that in the organized sector, right, it's fine. Unions have members. This improves the communication that they have with their members, improves probably their ability to increase their density because non-members will suddenly see the benefit and all the rest of it. But in the non-organised sector, it could be hugely valuable. And given that most of the UK labour market now, unfortunately, is non-organised, what's the delivery route? Or does it take actually unions to really say, do you know what, we are going to spend some of our members' money on people who aren't members? Because we think that's...
Well, hopefully in the name of solidarity, that's what unions will do, right? And I think we always have to look inwards. It's easy to point fingers, unions have declined in membership because, politicians did this, or because employers are engaging in union busters, which they unforgivably are. But I think we also have to look inwards, right? And there's a lot of people around in the union movement who are actually asking the question, well, should we change the way we communicate? Are we actually good enough at saying, what have we done for workers? Now, do we
even ask the question?
And when I was working in the Nordic region, we actually did a little analysis of this, and lots of people in the Nordic region are members of a union, 80%. But the majority who weren't, their response was, well, I've never been asked to join. So, we might also take ourselves for granted and what, the goodness that we've done for granted. And I think this is a way to say, well, how do we communicate to young people? What is the benefits of joining a union? But how do we also become relevant for their world? And this adaptability, this curiosity, this willingness to change, I think is something that many think unions can't do. But I think our project and the partners we're working with across the world really proves different. But it is, you have to be bold and you have to be curious.
You're right. Curiosity and boldness need to be joined together. And you're right. The criticism I hear most often actually is a fear of curiosity, an aversion to curiosity. You can feather your own comfort zone to such an extent it becomes a silo that closes in over your head and suffocates you.
But can I just add there, Simon? I mean, yes, that's right. But I also think, this AI-driven, this robotic algorithms, data world is scary. And I don't think we should necessarily underestimate it. But this is not a call to go, oh, it's so scary, I should do nothing. This is a call to everybody and say, I think we've got 2 to 3 years to get this right. We've got 2 to 3 years to start turning the tides around a demand for responsible data governance, a demand of collective right of access to data. The breaking up of the monopolization of control and ownership of our data. We have to do this now, and we have to really start saying enough is enough. We have to start urging our local governments, our regions, our national governments, our communities to say we want to be empowered by this information and not only objectified, becoming like, Johnny's no longer seen as the man he is with his good sides and bad sides and whatever. He is being judged digitally. The digital profiles of Johnny decide what news he sees on Facebook, what goods or services he gets offered. But it's not him. We're no longer seeing him. We're seeing these digital profiles. So recently, on Facebook and other places, I've been out with a call for the right to be human. I want the right to be seen, to be with all of my fallacies and all of my problems and all my beauties and my big heart, but I want the right to be judged, valued, seen as a human and not as a numerous digital profiles.
There's a funny kind of thought experiment you can do here, which is, so in the UK, if we were to introduce a new bank holiday every year, that would give us approximately 250 years to figure out an end to work. And just as a thought experiment, I think it compels us to think through, which battle, what will the next 100 years of the labor movement look like? So I think it's the 100th anniversary of the ILO this year. And you just have to think, you know, we know the narratives around artificial intelligence. We've heard the kind of image of the future where we don't have to work anymore. And I think what I really like about working with Christina is thinking through pragmatically what would need to change for us to kind of catch up with these technologies. What sort of values would we want to see instilled in labor organizations, but also in technology, to coexist with what might conceivably be possible if X percentage of jobs disappear? What would the world look like?
Well, I agree that is a very exciting and I think worthwhile prospect, because it makes you think about what the priorities are, how you're how you're going to address those priority issues, whether they're things you want to address or that you are confronted with. But I think what's particularly impressive about this work is at the moment, I don't think people generally have the words to articulate this sort of stuff. No. And I think, no messing and no false modesty. The work you're doing is thought leadership work as well as technologically innovative. And I think that is so, so important, because otherwise, if we don't have the words, we don't have the tools to give meaning to the ideas. This is all getting really heavy, listeners, and very deep, and it is the stuff of now.
Yeah, and we are at a breaking point in history. I think everybody who's above 30, we have sleepwalked into this current situation. We never question, why was Facebook for free? Why did we get Google Translate for free? Why was all of these things for free? You know, it wasn't, let's face it, until Facebook, Cambridge Analytica scandal that people started waking up to, they've taken my data. We have really, really, really not done our due diligence around this. So now we're at this time where it's going, stop. This is scary. You know, when I moved to Switzerland, I bought a television. There was a big fat sticker on there saying, please do not hold a private conversation in front of this television. Now, excuse me, what am I supposed to do in my lounge if it's not have a private conversation? But it was because it was equipped with listening software, so I could speak to it and say, turn on, turn off. You know, of course, I've cut that off now. But it goes to show that, you know, this lust for convenience, this lust for speed, for ease, has been sold to us as empowering. But actually, what it has done is split us, divided us.
Atomized us.
Yeah. And I think we're waking up to that now on a general scale, and we should take that anger and we should take that almost disgust around this and actually tunnel it into something constructive, and that's what we're trying to do.
No, well, that, and all power to your elbow, because actually it's not a lust, it's an intoxication. We're intoxicated and addicted to convenience, I think.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, they are hard chains to break. If I can bring it back down to a sort of local level, as it were, how close are you to operationalizing some of this stuff? Or is it already rolling out in some places?
Well, we are already now testing the off-the-shelf thought exchange, so that online town hall. As part of our project, we have some licenses that we're offering to Uni's members so they can use the tool as well. This has really given some interesting results, more and more will be coming. Our own app, which we're having developed, will be ready to be launched on the Android platform in about June.
Wow.
So we'll be...
And we're recording this at the beginning of April, so not long away.
And then we're also having it designed for Apple iOS, and that should be ready to be launched after the summer. So, you know, I think by the end of this year, we'll have some very exciting test cases. We'll be able to see how unions adapt to the use of this technology, how workers can benefit from it. And hopefully in that way, balance out the scale of information asymmetry right now.
And if our listeners want to find out more, want to see more, what's the best way for them to get a better understanding into the work that you're doing?
So we have just created a webpage on our website called The Lab. So our website is www.thefutureworldofwork.org. And as part of that website, you'll see on the top there something called The Lab. And in there, we will be posting blog posts. We have already blog posts now, but we will have user stories. we'll be showing how unions are using this, and there'll be lots of growing information.
Excellent. And can we come back and continue this discussion?
Anytime.
At a later date? It's such a fast-moving scenario.
Yeah.
Christina, Johnny, thank you so much for spending time with us. Absolutely fascinating, and the very best of luck.
Thank you, Simon. So thank you.
Well, listen, that was really kind of, I think, long horizon thinking and explanations from two of the best in the business on this. And I love Christina's kind of rallying call at the end that we either act now or pay the price. But if we act now, we can do something with these algorithms and artificial intelligence, and we can harness it for the good of the many.
Yeah.
Not the few, to coin a phrase.
Not a few. You've heard that one before. I grew up reading Isaac Asimov books. So I have had this kind of very lackadaisical, loose idea about the robots coming and taking jobs and it being awful, because I was like, it's okay, as long as they've got like first principles, we'll all be all right. And I think that what I find really refreshing when you hear Johnny and Christina talk about this is that they're not starting off from a position of saying this is evil, these are bad things. It's inherently, it's neutral. It's just who has control over them and how are things used that benefit the wider community and not just an exalted few. And I don't know whether any listeners have watched the TV program on Netflix called Altered Image or something like that, right? Where basically it's this idea that, can't remember, but basically the whole premise is that in this futurescape, your memories and your kind of core essence is downloaded onto a track in your nervous system, in your sort of spinal cords, and basically you're just literally transferred, your essence is transferred from a body to a body, and therefore you can live forever. And the only way you can die is by this kind of core essence disc being destroyed. Forgive me, listeners, there is a point to this ambling story, but in a lot of these kind of stories you have this kind of vast disparity between what the people who control the data or the people who have had access to the data right at the beginning and those who are just still kind of doing the job. And it makes me think of that idea of we need to kind of act now so that that equality is and that justice is built into the systems that control, the systems that design all of these algorithms, because otherwise we're creating a new type of society that will just benefit a few people. And the problem is that this concentrated wealth, I think, is more globalized than ever before, and so that is going to cause not just disparities within countries but also just even more disparities between countries. And I think that there is also issues about who is it built for, but I mean, I could go on about it.
Well, I mean, I think the point is well made, Becky, but I think the point is you've undercooked it slightly. This is happening now.
Yeah,
we've got algorithms that are controlling people's lives, controlling people's jobs, controlling virtually every aspect of their life, and it will become more so once 5G gets rolled out. We're addicted to convenience on these things. And who programs the algorithms? If they are, for the sake of argument, white, straight men,
make that point. Yeah,
you're just gonna, there's a whole raft of bad things that flow from that. And it's, this is not pie in the sky stuff. When seatbelts were first being designed, seatbelts were designed assuming women weren't going to drive or be in the front seat, and therefore women died in road accidents needlessly because the design was sexist in its preconception.
I could continue with that with loads of different examples of it. But that is the case. It is going to it's not just going to be straight white men, but it's going to be straight white men of particular countries as well. And that's a whole different discussion. But I think kind of coming back to Christina and kind of Johnny's work, I think it's really inspiring to see some very clever people present horizon scanning and future horizon scanning and saying, right, what could we do now? What could we do in the future? What could we do now that would have this really positive impact in the future? And I know a couple of the unions that are doing some of the projects with them. And it's super interesting and really exciting. I'm really keen to see what happens with like all the other projects and stuff that they're doing. So congrats
and power to your elbow. And don't forget, listeners, the Town Hall initiative is going to be available very, very soon if it isn't already by the time you're listening to this. Whew, breathless stuff. That's just about it for this podcast, listeners. Thank you so much for spending time with us. We've been delighted to have your company. We'd love to hear what you think about this episode or about any episode. You can tell us what you think. You can join the discussion by emailing us at info@unions21.org.uk. You can tweet us at unions21. Say hi on social media. Please do so. And conferences are coming, isn't it?
Conferences are coming. I mean, feel free to email in and say that my rambling story about altered carbon was a bit off piece, but I think the point was well made. Yeah, conference is coming, everyone. 21st of May, you can get your tickets over on the website. The future of collective voice and what that looks like, and a whole host of speakers looking at what digital transformation is. So actually, we really enjoyed Christina. Then come along and hear her talk in a bit more detail about this kind of stuff. She is speaking at conference. We're looking at private sector organising. We're looking at health sector organising. We're looking at change in unions. We're looking at what is the future of unions and the role of collective voice in that.
The Union 21 conference, it's good for you. It's good for your union.
Indeed. Be there. Be square.
So that just leaves us with one request to you, dear listeners, and that is, if you have enjoyed what you've heard, then please share us, rate us on the podcasting platform of your choice, leave us a little review saying how much you enjoyed and what you enjoyed, and basically spread the word, because we can't do it without you. We need the big wide world to know even more than they do at the moment about Unions 21 podcast.
Yeah, we need to beat the algorithms, and this is our way of beating the algorithms, listeners.
That's for sure. We'll be back next week, listeners. Until then, do take good care, and thanks for listening. So from Becky and myself, it's
goodbye.
The Unions 21 podcast was presented by Becky Wright and Simon Sapper. It was a Makes You Think production.